Okay, this is Tracy Wilson and Champaign-Urbana interviewing Judy McCullough in her house on Oregon Avenue.
Yes.
Okay, so, well, my first question is, how did you become interested in traditional music? And I know we talked about that a little bit the last time I met with you, but, and I'm sure it's something that might not be that simple to answer.
Well, the big jump came during the so-called folk revival. And I had gone to junior college, Cotty College, down in Nevada, Missouri, where my English composition teacher, Joan Miller, was becoming interested in folk song and folk music and introduced some of us to recordings of Burl Ives and Dyer Bennett and people like that. And then from there, I bought a few recordings, a few LPs back in the old days, and kept getting closer and closer to original sound, you might say, to the folk. I remember when, I may have told you this, when Richard Dyer Bennett came to Nevada, Missouri to give a concert, he introduced the program by saying, "I need to make a distinction. There are folk singers, and there are singers of folk songs. I am a singer of folk songs." And I thought, wow, epiphany. And so I realized that what I had first heard on my English teacher's LPs were singers of folk songs. And what I became more and more curious about were the folk singers themselves from which these songs came. So I started buying Folkways Records and Prestige International. Kenny Goldstein was putting out some recordings not too long after that. I forget if he was already putting them out, but Folkways, Stinson was around, Ash Records, some of those, and gradually accumulated a library. But hadn't heard too much when I was growing up, at least I never put a label to it, because my mom sang maybe two songs at home, and that was about it. And church style turns out to be something of a traditional style, unaccompanied four-part singing. It was related to Amish Mennonite singing, and in German as well as in English, actually at the same time, depending on what the first language was. But I never thought of that as anything unusual because it was all around.
So is your family German?
My four grandparents were born in Germany.
Oh.
And my folks spoke German when they were little until they went to school. Mm-hmm. And my mom says when she was in Sunday school, when she was little, they used to teach the kids German so that when they grew up and went upstairs to hear the sermon, they could understand the sermon, which was still in German. And gradually, as the first generation died off, the next generation were mainly English speakers, and the sermons and the hymnals gradually went into English only and not this dual language thing.
Do you know what part of Germany they came from?
They were mainly from roughly southwest around Stuttgart and up in the Kraichgau, area called Kraichgau near Gemmingen. And before that, they had come from Switzerland, from near Bern, south of Bern. And they were some of the early Mennonites who were persecuted there and got kicked out.
Okay.
And a pretty bloody affair back then. And that batch fled not to up into Holland and then over to Pennsylvania, that route. But they came up into southern Germany and then pretty directly to the Midwest. So that's that.
And what was the name of the town you said your family, or you went to school in Missouri?
Oh, that was college. That was Nevada, spelt Nevada.
Uh-huh.
But Nevada, Missouri, and it was Cotty College, C-O-T-T-E-Y. It was sponsored by the PEO Sisterhood, which I suspect, although they claim it's a big secret, I suspect it stands for Philanthropic Educational Organization. At least that would fit their mission.
What part of the state is that?
It's, let's see, it's on the west side, not far from the Kansas border, because we used to take bus trips up to the Kansas City Philharmonic. Be maybe a couple of hours, so it's pretty much straight south from Kansas City, Missouri. Yeah.
Okay. I'm from Missouri, and I don't know the state very well. St. Genevieve, so the eastern part of the state.
Oh yeah, that's French country.
Yeah. Oh, but my family's mostly German too. So.
Oh. Yeah.
Wow. So you that was in the 50s or the?
That was in, let's see, I went there, what would that have been? 52 to 54, I was in Missouri. Yeah, graduated 54 out there. It's a long time ago. So if my memory is good, that's what it was.
Yeah. I see. And but your interest continued after that, I guess?
Yes, it did. Mm-hmm. And I had the chance to hear a few people live, as it were. And of both categories, folk singers, singers of folk song. I remember when I was in Ohio after that, Pete Seeger came through. Hmm. And it was a rather unusual concert because he was up against the House Un-American Activities Committee in those days. And he didn't get around too awfully much.
So you went to school in Ohio after that?
I went from Missouri, I went to Ohio Wesleyan for 2 years, got my BA there. And then went to Ohio State, got an MA in English in 57, started a doctorate in English, kind of old English, middle English, philology sort of stuff, and got a Fulbright for 58, 59 to go to Belgium to study Sanskrit, which tied in with what I was doing. And in the spring before I went over, the Ohio Folklore Society had a meeting in Columbus, and a fellow named Richard Dorson came over to give a talk, and he brought with him a musical group. And I think it was Ellen Steckert and Bruce Buckley and maybe Joe Hickerson. It is part of that. People like that would have come over, and I can't remember specifically without looking it up. But he said, oh, this summer there's going to be this Folklore Institute at Indiana. It's 6 or 8 weeks long, and a lot of good people are going to show up. Y'all come. So I thought, got a free summer before I have to get on the boat and go over to Belgium. So went off to Indiana, and just fell in love with everything that people were doing there. And it was the most incredible mixture of people. There were utter amateurs who knew nothing. They were interpreters. Mm-hmm. They knew that. There were people who had been doing research, people who had been writing for decades. Archer Taylor was there. Vance Randolph came. Jameson came. Catherine Luomala came from Hawaii. And just wonderful people, and then a lot of students at different levels, whether they had a smattering of knowledge, which is what I would say I had at that point. And everybody was equal. There was no sense of rank or status or privilege there, and it was just one big family of people interested in tradition. And it was so unusual and so unlike the academic departments where you're constantly watching over your shoulder to see if somebody's going to steal your dissertation topic and write it up before you get there and that kind of thing. So suddenly the world, intellectual world's wide open. Anyway, I was there for the summer and then went off to Belgium, and instead of coming back to Ohio State and going back into English, I came to Indiana and started on a PhD program there, which I finally got through and graduated. That was that.
It's interesting because Dorson has a reputation among some people as not liking folk music that much.
Oh, he didn't understand it. He was tone deaf. And he didn't think anything good, because he couldn't do anything with music. He assumed that nobody else could do anything with music either. And he could make life miserable. for anybody interested in music.
Really?
I mean, Neil Rosenberg, whose book we just saw the first copy of there, was doing his doctoral work down there, wanted to write about the music scene over at Bean Blossom, where Bill Monroe had his festival and his,
right.
His jamboree and so forth. And Neil was doing incredible first-hand research. He was playing in the house band. He was kind of running things for a while. And Dorison said, no, this is not a true topic. Thou shalt write on parrot jokes or some such thing. And Neil had to do his dissertation on something like parrot jokes. I know, it was just some stupid thing.
So did he end up, what did he do in the end?
In the end, he got his degree writing on something that was non-musical. And then he eventually started teaching up at Newfoundland, where he finished his history of bluegrass. As he said, it gives you perspective to be up there in St. John's, Newfoundland. And so he more than overcame the challenge of trying to work with Dorison. I got through only because my real advisor was George List, who directed the, came out of the music school down there and directed the archives for many years, and had managed to get a number of grants. And this is something Dorison respected.
I mean,
money talks.
Right.
So I thought, this is a power player, so be nice to him. And I'm sure that's the only reason I got through. But Mayne Smith wrote his master's on bluegrass with Alan Merriam, anthropologist down there, ethnomusicologist, world-renowned. And Dorison gave them so much grief over that that Merriam swore off ever working with any folklore student ever again.
Really? Yeah. Well, that's too bad.
Yeah. Now, Dorson's mind was not as open as it might have been. And his tolerance was not as wide as it might have been, to put it that way. And I remember when the first day I was there, when all the folklore students gathered, we could then fit around a library table on the third floor of the old library. There weren't very many of us. And Ellen Steckert was there, and we were sharing a house out on South Rogers Street. And she had made a mark as a folk singer, a singer of folk songs. And she had done some collecting, and by that time she'd made a record or two. And it had a lovely voice. It had a long braid down her back. And I remember he looked around the room and he said, "Now, we are students of folklore, and we are going to be respectable. We are going to be respected. We're going to make the field respected. And we are going to act the part, and there will be," he says, looking at her, "there will be no long-haired singers of folk songs in this folklore program."
But so she stayed, right?
She stayed long enough to get her master's, and then she went to Penn. She just cleared out and got her degree from Penn then.
Okay.
So he could make life pretty interesting for people and not too happy.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Yeah. You know, there are a lot of Dorson legends, and
yes.
Maybe kinder not to repeat too many of them.
Yeah.
But those I know firsthand.
Yeah. Well, my next question then is, how did you end up at the University of Illinois?
Oh, I was trying to finish my coursework in folklore, and I had some required courses to take. We got married 61, and this was the closest he could get a job. So we were commuting our first year, because I had to stay at Indiana and finish up coursework, which Dorson was teaching. And so beginning of the school year, I went to see him to see what, because I couldn't find the courses scheduled anywhere. He said, "Oh, I decided not to teach those until next summer." So there I was, and there we were commuting. But then it was an excellent department, as it turned out, for Leon. So we stayed here. And that's where eventually I met Archie and got involved in the Folk Song Club. It was, and this was before interstate, so we'd trundle back and forth every weekend, either going one way or the other way. And mm-hmm. we knew all those little towns and all the little cafes. And
it's probably a more interesting trip. Then.
Well, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, I would say so.
So did you meet your husband in Bloomington?
I met him in Ohio.
Oh, really?
Back when I was at Ohio Wesleyan.
Uh-huh.
And he was actually a year ahead of me there. And then he later went to Ohio State, mm-hmm. and again a year ahead of me.
Awesome.
So we kind of kept track over the years and decided we got along pretty well, so might as well make it permanent. So we did. It's been a while now.
Wow. It's great that the movie worked out.
Oh, yeah. It actually worked out very well. Yeah. But who could predict?
Right. So how did you get involved with the Campus Folk Song Club? Do you remember how that came about?
Not specifically, mm-hmm. but I know that there were folk sings. There were some in the basement of Channing Murray, a place mm-hmm. called the Red Herring. It was like a coffee house sort of place.
There's still something there.
There's something. I've not been there for quite some time. But they used to gather there, and when they grew out that space, the group that got together and took turns singing and playing at each other, and for whatever audience might show up, they started booking some of the larger halls, like Lincoln Hall, Gregg Hall, mm-hmm. and would get together there once a month, something like that,
mm-hmm.
and you'd see posters around, folks saying, you know, come, mm-hmm. sing, get on the program. So we were never on the program, but we started going to the folk sings. And since Archie was brought in as the faculty advisor, every group on campus had to have a faculty advisor. You know how Archie is. You can't not get drawn into it.
Mm-hmm.
So Archie engages everybody, you know, conversation and work. And so gradually we became part of the steady people who didn't graduate and move on.
Mm-hmm.
So it was probably a combination of the folk sings happening, mm-hmm. and Archie corralling everybody he could for the cause.
Right. Do you remember meeting him?
I'd met him before, because he had come down to Indiana.
Mm. Okay.
And when he was coming through doing research for, I want to say it was his book Only a Minor, which was first his dissertation, and mm-hmm. then he added two or three chapters when he turned it into a book, which was the first book in the music series, and this is maybe book 135, the one I just showed you.
Okay.
So Archie claims he named that series Music in American Life.
Yeah.
And, who am I to say no? I don't know. I'll give Archie his credit for just about anything. So where was I going with that?
I just asked how you met him, and you said you met him in Indiana.
Yeah, that's right. He came through, and I think he slept on our floor, this little house we had on South Rogers.
Uh-huh.
And he knew Ellen more than he knew me,
mm-hmm.
probably because she'd been out doing some collecting herself and was known as a singer. And so I was just there and got to meet him.
Mm-hmm.
That he would have been, he tended just to pick up and travel around and interview people.
Right.
Incredible work, actually.
Yeah. And he was here at that time, or was he somewhere else whenever?
He was, he'd come here, I want to say at the invitation of Martin Wagner, who was then director of the ILIR, the Labor Institute.
Mm-hmm.
And went to school here, got his master's in library science,
mm-hmm.
and then tried to, so he was here for a while, then he tried to break into the folklore crowd and give papers and publish and whatnot, and he said he kept running into this opposition of, you know, disdain. People would say, but you don't have your PhD,
mm.
Reed. How can you possibly know anything about folklore?
Hmm.
Well, he had done more work than most of those people
yeah.
had. So eventually he left here and went to Penn and got his degree there.
Mm-hmm.
wrote the dissertation on coal mining songs, which is what eventually turned into the book Only a Miner. Mm-hmm. So he was around, you know, as long as I can remember.
Mm-hmm. So before you came here, he was here?
He could have been. Uh-huh. I'd have to check notes about when he came, but he could very well have been.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like what he told me is that he came here, did his master's degree in like a year or something.
Yeah.
And then maybe went back briefly to San Francisco, and then they came here.
I'm not sure Luann and the kids were here.
Yeah.
The first time.
Yeah, I don't think they were.
That's possible. I'm not too sure of his movements, but I have the impression maybe he was here by himself when he got his master's.
Yeah, I think so.
And then went back and brought the family. Because mm-hmm. once they were here, and the Folk Song Club was putting on concerts, it was always Archie's house that was open afterward.
Oh.
And Luann would just put food out and people bring food, and it was not fancy at all. But it was so friendly and so hospitable. And just another chance for people from the campus and people from town and people who were brought in to perform. Mm-hmm. Just everybody, it was like the Folklore Institute at Indiana when I first went there. It was a wonderful atmosphere. The breaking down barriers.
So you think that kind of breaking down between town and university was mm-hmm. was present at Indiana as well when you were first there?
No, because the people who... There wasn't such a group as the Folk Song Club.
Mm-hmm.
They did develop a club later, but how much... That was after I left, so I can't speak to that. In terms of the Folklore Institute, I don't know how much there was from town.
Uh-huh.
I think that was...
Oh, you're talking about the Summer Institute.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and otherwise, there wasn't that much give and take.
Uh-huh.
There were some of us went out to listen to people play, and some people went out to play with people who played in the countryside, and then went to square dances where the fiddler went and that sort mm-hmm. of thing. But I don't have any sense that there was that kind of breaking down of barriers at Indiana through the regular year, mm-hmm. in the regular course of things, as there was here.
Mm-hmm. But here you think that was a strong
course. Oh, yeah,
course.
that was highly unusual, and mm-hmm. it was an incredible thing to have happen.
Yeah.
And partly it was Archie's democratic spirit, too. Right. He wasn't going to pull status on anybody. No, far from it. The first thing he does, he comes in your house, takes his shoes off.
Mm-hmm.
You know he feels at home.
Right.
And even, you know, take his tie off, except he rarely wears a tie. But he'd take his jacket off, loosen his collar, take his shoes off. Sometimes he takes his socks off. I figure, all right, it's all right. Be comfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So was there this involvement from the local community? Is that something that evolved, or was it there from the beginning? Or
it had to evolve, and people from the community were discovered, as it were, and brought in. Like Archie took an ad over to the Daily Illini once for, I don't know, a concert or a folk sing or something, and I've heard it two ways. One, he either met one of the printers who worked over there, or somebody said, "Oh, there's this guy who's a printer for the DI." Who is a musician from Southern Illinois. Anyway, Archie met Lyle Mayfield, who's down from Greenville, mm-hmm. on old Route 40 toward St. Louis, and discovered that he and his wife were traditional musicians from down there who also played some popular stuff, like 50s songs, in 40s and 50s. They played the whole gamut, whatever people wanted to hear, which is how it usually is, as you know. And so he said, "Well, why don't you come pick a few songs at the folk sing?" And Lyle at first thought, these college kids are just going to ridicule us hillbillies. But he came, and everybody made over them. And they just got taken in. And then you'd hear about somebody living up here on Hickory in Urbana, who was an old-time singer.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody went to visit and said, know, you can really sing some great songs. Why don't you come sing with the folk sing? So that person would show up. And then Lyle knew an old-time fiddler, Stell Elam, and she played fiddle down near Greenville. And he brought her up one time, and she came out. And they were very well received because what counted was the music. And it wasn't the status or the race or the economic class or political persuasion. There's if they'd started talking politics, there would have been sparks, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
But that
but
was...
You don't remember that happening?
Or? No, and people were pretty careful, I think, just mm-hmm. to just let the love of music bring them together.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very democratic effort. Unusual for the campus, I would think.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like it.
Yeah.
And, go ahead,
sorry. Oh, I was going to say, some of Archie's efforts were, well, there's a little newsletter. And Fritz, I think, was editor for a while, or maybe...
The Auto Harp?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the Auto Harp came out, and Ron Foreman did reviews of blues and jazz records. Other people review other things. People write reviews of concerts or recordings, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
There'd be previews of coming attractions. They'd just run off a little masthead. I've got it somewhere. And
mm-hmm.
run off on a, I want to say a Ditto machine or a Mimeo machine, and then stapled and stuck in campus mail, and out it went.
Mm-hmm.
And
who printed those?
I think they were, I'm not sure they were professionally printed. They may have been. Archie kind of schlepped a lot of stuff for the Labor Institute,
uh-huh.
so I'm not sure exactly where those things were printed.
Huh. I didn't think to ask that before.
Yeah, and I frankly don't remember,
because
I wasn't involved with that. I got more involved with the recordings that the Folk Song Club put out. Not the first one, which was the Philo Glee and Mandolin Society.
Right.
That, have you talked to Doyle Moore?
I'm hoping to soon. I've talked to him on the phone briefly.
Yeah, you need to do that, because he was one of the members of the PG&MS.
Yeah.
And that came out first, and then there was field recordings from Central and Southern Illinois with the Mayfields,
right.
and Stell Elam, and some other people who were mm-hmm. around here. And then the third one was Glenn Orlin, the cowboy rodeo
right.
guy who came through here that we really ran onto down at the Ozark, what was it called? The Ozark Folk Festival, Eureka. It was in Eureka Springs, Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it was called the Ozark Folk Festival, I can't remember. Anyway, it was in Eureka Springs. And Archie describes the scene of Harry Glenn sing late at night. This haunting cowboy song that just sent chills up his bones.
Mm-hmm.
And typical Archie struck up conversation, and we invited him up to give a concert. And he gave one in Purdue en route, which mm-hmm. was his first college concert, and then came here and recorded the concert.
Yeah.
And most of the record came from here with maybe a cut or two from Purdue.
Oh, so the album that
it was called The Hellbound
was
Trade
from the live recording here?
I want to say it was.
Okay.
Yeah, I want to say it was.
I didn't realize that. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So Archie heard him playing at a festival in the Ozarks?
Yeah.
Because
Glenn had gone down there. He was a cowboy, and he wanted some land where he could run cattle.
Mm-hmm.
And they had pretty cheap land in Stone County, Arkansas. Where Jimmy Driftwood, a name you might know, where he lived near there. And they still had open range. So Glenn bought him some acreage and some cattle and lived pretty much hand to mouth, but pick up a few extra dollars singing places. Or he was very good. He'd paint signs with poster paint on storefront windows, like Rodeo Coming to Town.
Really?
And he put the title, and it was great animated bucking horses and riders, and he was a wonderful artist.
Wow.
Really creative guy. So he'd pick up a few bucks that way, and he lived by his wits, pretty much. Yeah, and so he came up here, and he said, somebody asked him, I think it was Roger Ebert, reviewed that concert when he was here. And whether it was Roger who quoted this, or somebody asked Glenn, I can't remember, he said, Glenn, are you nervous giving a concert at a college? And he says, real laconic guy, he says, no. He said, after falling off bucking broncos, I can't get too hurt falling off a chair, he says. And then he just came out with his guitar and his hat, and then just all by himself, and it was just mesmerized everyone.
Really?
Told stories. And
wow.
Yeah. He's good.
He still lives down there, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
Yeah?
Yeah, he's still down there.
Because I just came across something about him on the web at the Cowboy Poetry Gathering. I think
he's been invited out to the Elko thing a few times already. Yeah, because he's like many cowboys, he's written songs, and he's gathered. He's a natural folklorist.
Mm-hmm.
And he was gathering songs before we ever met him, and we persuaded him to pick his 100 favorite songs and a few stories and write them down and talk about them. And
so you worked on a book with him?
Yeah, and that was that book,
mm-hmm. yeah.
also called The Hellbound Train. So right. that followed Archie's very closely.
Mm-hmm.
You see
in the series?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's out of print now, unfortunately,
but
still a great book.
Yeah.
It went into paperback, lasted quite a long time.
Let's see. What role did the club play at the U of I?
Well, it was this democratizing role, I would say. And it obviously had huge entertainment value. And it was a participatory group, an opportunity for students to make music, to hear music, to learn about music, to get involved in the mechanics of running an organization, to the extent that there were committees and somebody had to chair the committee. And I remember Archie lit into somebody one time who was not used to governance procedures, let alone governance language. And the student was telling somebody, oh, I'm involved with the Folk Song Club, and I rule over such and such a committee. And Archie says, you do not rule over a committee. I mean, you may chair a committee, but that's it. And so we're picking up okay.
Yeah.
So Archie was, he was coaching all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he was teaching life lessons that people, I'm sure, had no idea what he was teaching them. And yet, you run into some of the students who were in the club, you know, years later, and they still think back on that experience as something formative. And I think it was as much Archie's example of what could be done when people work together for a common good,
mm-hmm.
a common cause. So that was, again, that was, I would say, a very major contribution that the Folk Song Club made to this campus and to the community, because it did pull in people from all those realms
mm-hmm.
without a sense of prejudice or hierarchy.
Climate of the 1960s have an impact on the club and how its members perceived themselves? Was that a component at all of, any of their identities, I guess?
I don't remember it as a major component.
Mm-hmm.
I think by the time Vietnam came along, the Folk Song Club was easing out of its prominence.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened when rock and roll became more prominent, and students who were not committed to traditional sounds or doing anything with them kind of shifted their allegiance over to rock. Mm-hmm. And so the membership of the club fell, and after a while was not really viable anymore and disbanded. Mm-hmm. I don't remember that it was a huge political organization at the time. People could have expressed themselves in song politically, and I don't think that would have been frowned upon. I have no memory of anybody getting very agitated about that. Mm-hmm. But I associate, for example, Archie's strategies in striking, anti-war striking on campus, mm-hmm. with a slightly later period.
Hmm. I see. So maybe like 67, 68?
Yeah, around in there somewhere. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I see. When would you say was sort of the heyday of the campus?
Oh, I'd say in the mid 60s.
So like 63, 65.
Yeah, around in there, at least to my memory.
That sounds about right. I was just looking at Otto Harp kind of getting a sense of when it seemed mm-hmm. that people were really contributing a lot and mm-hmm. how often it was coming out.
Mm, yeah, that's a good measure.
How would you describe the impact that your involvement in the club had on you then and later?
Oh, then? Well, let's see. I think what the club impelled me to do was get involved in research that I had not planned to get involved with. Mm-hmm. Like, writing notes for the two records made me learn more about local culture, local history, and more specific histories of the songs and tunes involved. And certainly I never thought very much about cowboy music, but made it a point to learn what I could about that and started that part of my library. Archie grew up on cowboy stuff. Mm-hmm. With movies and being in the West and all. But around Peoria, Illinois, you don't see too many cowboys. And we didn't go to movies, so I didn't have that exposure. So part of it was just learning about new things and also practice getting stuff out, being productive in a tangible sense. That is, there was the little bibliography of Illinois folklore that I put together, and then working on the two LPs. That was something I'd never done before. I don't think I got too involved in the concert arrangements that tended to be handled by somebody else. The newsletter, I might have helped with a little bit, but not in a major way. Kind of ferrying people around, because I knew some folklorists already, so when lecturers came in, it could help explain to them what the club was about and be a facilitator in that sense, although I don't think I was ever at a microphone to do a public presentation. About as close as I got to a microphone was before one of the folk sings. I took my cylinder player in and some cylinders with the old Morning Glory horn, and I forget what I played or why I was doing this, but I just what's he?
I can pause it. Oh, he's just I'm telling you the cat's sitting out there.
Oh, that's Cute. Yeah, Leon's off taking a shower. He's disappeared.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. He's got to go meet a student after a bit, so.
And in terms of the long-term influence on you, was there some particular things that stayed with you?
I would say habits. And with Archie as a model for how things could be accomplished. A very good thing could be accomplished with a few resources and a little bit of imagination and a lot of collaboration with other people as necessary. That was a huge model, I think, for everybody. And I keep coming back to Archie, but that's what people do. They keep coming back to Archie, yeah. Which is why he got this Living Legend Award.
Yeah, that's great. I'm so glad.
Yeah, that's very good.
Yeah, he seems like he's been an amazing influence on so many
people. Yeah. Well, he made everything seem worthwhile. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just fun and frills. There was a lot of fun, and there were some light moments, but I think we all had the sense that what we were doing counted for something. Mm-hmm. It was really important to do it, and that the people that we were working with, whether town, gown, whatever, mm-hmm. everybody merited some attention for whatever reason. And I think for those students who were maybe a little elitist when they came here, mm-hmm. that was a good corrective. Mm-hmm. And for those of us who didn't come out of an elite background, mm-hmm. it was an affirmation that we were worth something too.
Right.
Just like neighbors and friends and people came in to sing or to talk and mm-hmm. and again, it was very democratic. Like Archie used to say, he says, when he was lobbying for the Folklife Center, he went into some senator's office, and the senator said, Professor Green, are you a conservative? And Archie says, Senator, I'm so conservative, I still believe in democracy.
Yeah,
that's a just classic story. Yeah.
Oh, that is great.
Yeah.
Well, there was just a couple of specific things I wanted to ask you about. Mm-hmm. One was the Music in American Life series. I know we talked about it a little bit before.
Oh.
And I know that it sounds like it started back then with.
Yeah. Now that's not the Folk Song Club. That's
right.
That's
right.
We're switching gears
here.
Yeah, I
guess we are switching. Yeah. I'm just, since I, that's okay. Kind of one of your major accomplishments.
Yeah, I didn't actually start that.
Oh, really?
I came in on the ground floor, but our former director, Dick Wentworth, mm-hmm. had been director at LSU Press. Mm-hmm. He likes jazz a lot, and he had published some jazz books down there. In fact, I was just down in New Orleans, and people still remembered some of his books, the Danny Barker book, and so when he came up here as associate director, he looked around, he saw nobody was really doing American music in the broadest sense. Mm-hmm. He proposed to the then director that he start a series, which Archie claimed he named, because Archie was here then. Mm-hmm. This would have been maybe around 70 or so. And so he got permission to start this series called Music in American Life. Mm-hmm. And he did what you do when you start a series. You go out and you sign up a dozen books or so, and then you make a big hoo-ha announcement. And Archie's was mm-hmm. one. Archie's book had been floating around and was kind of in limbo somewhere else, and Archie fetched it back, and mm-hmm. it was published here as the first book, which was really, in some ways, the best in the series. But in terms of visual appearance, mm-hmm. Just the richness of it and the import of it.
Is it still in print?
Is
it still in print?
Just went out of print. Just recently went out of print. Mm-hmm. And it was selling about 2 copies a year. And it came out in 72. Mm-hmm. That was the first book. And I did the index for that. So the press kind of knew me from that, and mm-hmm. and the manuscript started to come in, and Wentworth was getting too over busy because he was always also the history editor, mainly the history editor. Mm-hmm. So he needed some help, and he mentioned this to Archie, and Archie said, oh, there's this woman in town, just got her degree, she knows everybody and everything. Well, sure. So Wentworth asks me if I'd be interested in coming to the press to develop books in folklore and music. And I didn't have any other prospects. And I'd run into the nepotism thing here because Leanne was on the faculty. So there was no hope in the English department or any place else except part-time, low-paid, last-minute work, which I thought, you know, life is short. I don't think so. So I went over. There was a half-time opening for a copy editor in the spring of 72, and I went for that. This is before we had to do affirmative action and all that. I just got hired and schlepped in that way. And pretty much acted as the editor in-house for the series ever since then. So I worked on Archie's book. I worked on Glenn Erland's book. I copy-edited that. Jeff Titon's early Down Home Blues, that was the very first manuscript I looked at when I walked in the press. I just sat at a desk and went through and made notes on it. So that my involvement with that started officially at the press in February of 72 and lasted until May 15th, 2007. So it's just a little bit more than 35 years. And there's 130-some books out, and the music of Bill Munro, Neil Rosenberg, and Charles Wolfe is most recent one.
Are there several others that are still in
there's
the
some, yeah, there's some. There's some in the works, and I'll get copies when they come out.
That's great.
But this came in over the weekend while I was away, so I was very happy to see it. It's not officially published yet.
Really?
Because books don't get published until maybe 6 to 8 weeks after they physically appear. You have to get them in the warehouse and log them in, get the review copies out so that when the reviews do come out, you have to plan everything ahead of time, all the publicity.
So had you had much editing experience before that?
Or? No, not really. I had edited a little newsletter down at Indiana at the archives called the Folklore and Folk Music Archivist, but that was maybe a 4-pager, 6-pager. That was not very much. And all I did there was solicit and check the language and check the sources. And it was honest editorial work, but it was nothing that major. But I'd never done book editing, which is a little bit different. So I just read the Chicago Manual at night and looked at how other people marked proof and manuscripts to see how they did it. And I went forth and did likewise. And then it's not hard if you have a basic sense for language, which I think I do. And then it comes with practice. Now everything's edited on screen. And it comes in on disc. Oops, something just popped there. You need to turn it over. Okay. It's gonna go. Yeah. Everything's edited on disc now.
Oh, really?
And so, you see the copy editors with their. The manuscripts on the screen, and they can type in queries and do their suggested editing in a different typeface or different color. And then that's printed out, author looks that over, and they resolve all the queries. And then the copy editor goes back in and zaps out all of the stuff that doesn't belong there anymore. So you wind up with a nice, pristine disc, which then goes to the designer and then to production and to the printer and so forth. So it's quite different now. I'd have to learn new skills. So I did some copy editing for about 10 years and then got full-time into acquisitions, which is what I'd gone there to do in the beginning. And copy edited maybe one or two books that were very special later on, like the Hank Snow book. I wanted to keep his language, which was very distinctive. And he's from Nova Scotia, and he had kind of interesting turns of phrase that might have gotten evened out if the standard grammarian type had gotten loose on him.
That's
so that I did.
Realized
that. He was said to be prickly, although I never had any problem working with him. And he was really great to work with. And then I got to present the book to him on the stage of the Grand Ole Opry when he was performing one night.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
That's great.
So he seemed to like it.
Super.
Yeah.
So was it hard to work with some authors? Are there a lot of...
Oh, there are some that are, fall into kind of an easy pattern, quicker than others do. Some, it's a matter of teaching every single step of the way, why you do something this way, why you don't do that, and what you need to have in, and don't forget now, because we can't do it without all of your permissions in hand. Some are harder to work with, some are easier to work with. It's just a cross-section of people. Mm-hmm. But most everybody is pretty good, because they know in the long run they want a book out.
Right.
And it's just going to be a little bit smoother if they understand how things work at our end. So.
Right. So your involvement with the U of I Press really followed the whole folk song club.
Yes.
Because that was pretty much the 70s.
Yeah, because the club was really out of it by the time I started. Right. By the time I finished my degree, which was in 70, and then started looking around what to do. Mm-hmm. And there comes Leon.
Hi,
this is Leon, this is Tracy, this is the maker of the friendship bread.
That was very good, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Bye.
Ooh. Yeah, I have to get that squeak. I think some WD-40 might help that, but I've not gotten up there yet, so. Yeah.
Wow, so you moved here in 63.
Yeah. I came over, got married 61. I came over in 62, and we lived in a sabbatical house, and then we bought this place in 63.
Wow.
So it's got some age on it. The mortgage is paid off. The house is falling apart, or it was until we spent our life savings trying to fix it up again.
Yeah, this part looks good.
Yeah, well, you don't see the boxes inside. So anyway.
Well, one other thing I wanted to ask you something I was thinking, because my parents actually have a house in Arkansas, not too far from where I think Glenn Orland is.
And oh, really?
I was considering trying to get in touch with him.
Oh.
I don't know, I'm just wondering if you think he would be receptive, or if are people bothering him a lot?
No, the worst he can do is say no.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, so he's in Mountain View.
Okay.
You look up, he's out in the country.
Mm-hmm.
But Mountain View would be the town.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of kind of folk music activity around Mountain View. So.
Yeah, that's a whole kettle of fish, too.
Oh, that, yeah? Is that a
Because
sort of
there
point?
There have been factions.
Oh, there are always factions.
And, Glenn can, if he wants to, he could tell you a lot.
Oh, really?
But he might or might not want to, I don't know. And the late Jimmy Driftwood was part of a faction, and then Bill McNeil, who was the folklorist at the Folklife Ozark Folk Center for a long time, which apparently just closed, and the collections are going elsewhere, and it's just strange.
Mm-hmm.
No, he got along with some people, didn't get along with other people. And the people come into the area who are not from there and want to sing and want to do things and get driven out again by Driftwood or some other faction, and then you had Arkansas state politics getting involved with funding for the Folk Center.
Huh.
Parks and Recreation, whatever it was, I think they put some money in, some other people put some money in.
Huh.
And I remember one time we were down there, and Jimmy Driftwood said, "We're thinking of building some kind of a center for folk music and folklore down here. And we need some specs for an archive and a library. Could you help us out with that?" And I think Doyle was down there, too.
Really?
And we came up with a lot of detail and you need this room for reception, you need this room, you need this equipment, you need these shelving, you need climate, and you need all this stuff. And sent this packet of stuff off, never heard boo. Not even we got it, let alone thank you. And then, you know, time went by, and next thing we know, they're building this center with a little archive. And, and I've not seen it, so I don't know how close it is.
I was there a couple of years ago.
Were you?
But, you know, yeah. I didn't have it, very briefly, just for a couple hours.
Oh. Was Bill McNeil there? Do you
know? I think he was.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, it seems like I was doing some research in southern Indiana with folk music, traditional fiddlers in particular. Mm-hmm. Ran into some rivalries and
oh,
like
yeah.
That.
Oh, yeah.
Always kind of, I guess it's inevitable. Like, it's human nature.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I should, I mean, I guess another component of my question about Glen Orland is, since my project is focused on the Folk Song Club, and I know he was, you know, a performer for them, but and I know that you collaborated on a couple of projects. I mean, would he be enough of a component to merit, you know, talking to? I mean, I'm sure that he merits an interview in his own right, but in terms of...
What would be interesting with Glenn would be the perspective of somebody from the folk community.
Yeah, definitely.
And we ran into this when Neil Rosenberg was editing the Transforming Tradition, so a collection of essays about the revival. And it was all from the perspective of the people, for outsiders, discovering others and, you know, recording them, appropriating their music, performing it, whatever. And I said, can't you get some quotes, at least, from the folk to balance this out? Like, what is it that we're transforming when we say transforming tradition? And I think I told him that story about Glenn's quip about falling off the chair versus falling off a horse. And that is that kind of comment from people who have been brought forward and put out to the public, that kind of comment is very hard to come by. So anything you can do to flesh that out, like, When Glenn was singing at this outdoors at night at this festival, after the festival proper performance in Eureka Springs, and Archie went up to him, what did he think? This funny little guy just coming up and talking to him about cowboy songs.
Yeah.
And I think he had sung the Hellbound Train. I think that's what he was singing. I just sent shivers through you. You know, it's kind of dark and moonlit and kind of spooky anyway. And then what did Glenn think when he got invited to come to do a concert and to do a concert on a college campus? And what did his first experience would have been at Purdue, as I said. But then this was the main one that he came for. And then later he was at the Chicago Folk Festival. What was it like? I mean, what did he think about the students? What did he think about the way he was received? Music, stories, himself as a person. What did he think about all that? And what did he take away from the experience? Because obviously we were intruding in, even though he traveled here, we were intruding into his life.
Yeah, it's interesting. And the whole process of, being put on stage and sought after.
Yeah, and then the record came out and he became a known quantity. And he got other college gigs and he went out to the Cowboy Poetry Gathering, and he's been in different places. Does he see that as a fleeting thing, that is not, his life doesn't go that direction anymore? Mm-hmm. And how dependent was that attention on the strength of the revival or the presence of those of us who were around at the time and then lived beyond that period? And what did his neighbors think when he was doing all this stuff? That is, we just don't know. If we could ask questions like that of everybody who's ever been stuck onto a stage, mm-hmm. I think that would be absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
And might set some of us back a step or two.
Yeah.
Because we think we're doing the right thing,
mm-hmm.
but are we doing the right thing?
Yeah. And it's hard to know what kind of impact
yeah.
that can have. So.
Oh, yeah.
I, they mentioned on the website for the Cowboy Poetry Gathering that he'd also received a National Heritage Fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, it was one of the NEA, mm-hmm. The Folk Arts
right.
Heritage Awards. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I'm sure this was all part of that later recognition. So.
Probably wouldn't have happened without mm-hmm. some... That is, the Folk Song Revival gave credentials
mm-hmm.
to people, and the Folk Song Club was part of that.
Mm-hmm.
For whatever purpose somebody wanted to make of credentials, like, I can make some extra money if I do this concert, and I can say, well, I was at Illinois, and that's Mecca, so you can hire me too, and here's my fee, and here's when I can come.
Mm-hmm.
Or... they love me there. Don't you, are you sure you don't want to do a recording of me?
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of deal can you cut?
Yeah.
I mean, it gave people some arguing space if they wanted to use it. If they didn't, why they didn't mm-hmm. have to.
Yeah.
But we just don't know a lot of those answers, which is, I think, a failing in a way.
Yeah.
That we're very... In a way, as democratic as it was, the Folk Song Club was also self-centered
mm-hmm.
in that sense
mm-hmm.
that we thought we were doing the right thing and we knew what the right thing was.
Yeah.
And we tried to be responsible, but in retrospect,
yeah.
you just don't know.
Yeah. Also, I mean, it'd be interesting to talk to some of the other musicians who are maybe more, even more local people, but I don't know if any of them are still around or how to go about tracking them down.
Lyle and Doris would be down in Greenville, 420 Trindle Avenue.
420 Trindle?
Trindle, and Greenville is just off old Route 40.
Mm-hmm.
Or what's that interstate that would go down? It would be I-70 maybe? Goes down to St. Louis. Isn't it 70?
70 yeah.
parallels 40, I think.
Right.
Okay.
It cuts across a little.
Yeah.
So they're off of 40.
Yeah. So that would be there.
And you think they're still?
They're still down there, as far as I know. Now, Stell Elam's gone. Now the Goodwins are gone. Kathy Reynolds might still be singing down there somewhere. She and her husband did gospel. She had an incredible voice.
Mm.
Oh, my goodness.
Mm.
Just over and out, just a huge, powerful, wonderful voice.
And she's on the Greenfields of Illinois
mm-hmm.
as well.
Yeah.
Is that, did the name have anything to do with Archie's last name, or is it?
No. There was this fiddle tune called Greenfields of America.
Oh, okay.
And so we just... And I can't remember if Stell played that tune. And I can't remember if she called it Greenfields of Illinois
mm.
or if we just sprung the title to fit the recording.
Mm.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So it would
be... She might be down there too?
She might be down there, and if anybody knew where she was, Lyle might know.
Okay.
I think I heard... You know, within the last couple of years that she was observed to be singing in somebody's church. So it could be she's still down around there.
Okay.
But boy, did she have a voice.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I remember some of the songs in that album being especially good, but now it's been...
You know, she did Tramp on the Street.
Okay.
And Lyle, I think, was playing mandolin on that. That was just... They were just messed around, and well, Thatcher Robinson had his tape recorder running, and they said, oh, let's do Tramp on the Street, and he kind of launched into it, and it was when they closed the album out with it.
With that version,
yeah.
Too?
Yeah.
Oh, that's
great. Oh, yeah. It just meshed.
So how do you remember how the idea to do albums came about?
It was what you did.
Really?
Because that's what people who got involved in the folk revival did. Mm-hmm. Now, Kenny Goldstein was the master of that.
I see.
And that was a way to get traditional sounds into the ears of people who otherwise might not hear them. Mm-hmm. And a venue for writing about the music and writing about the people who made it. It was a model, like if you're a scholarly society, you have to have a journal, because that's mm-hmm. what they do. Well, we were putting on concerts and, you know, discovering traditional musicians, and so that's what you do, you just put a record out.
I actually came across a website dedicated to Greenfields of Illinois, and it was by someone from the area who talked about on this webpage about how much he'd been influenced by the album.
Really?
And I emailed the guy and asked if he'd been involved with the CFC at all.
Yeah.
And he said that not really, that he was a high school student here at the time, and he remembers vaguely going to some of the folk sings, but
well, for him's sake,
hanging out in the back, but you know, he doesn't really remember what he saw, but that he was really influenced by the albums.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Remember what his name
was? Gosh, David something.
Well, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah, yeah. Oh. And he told me to get in touch with someone who's a professor here. He was, a high school friend of his at the time, and now I can't remember that guy's name.
I'll be darned.
I should look him up. Because that's interesting, too, you know, kind of the just little
the
ripples.
Ripple effect, yeah.
Of, you know, influence and, you know, remain.
Yeah.
I don't have any more questions. Is there anything else that, you know, had to do with the club that, you know, I might have missed that you can think of as being important?
Well, nothing much comes to mind that we haven't addressed at some point, I don't think.
Yeah,
I don't think I've added anything specific to your...
Oh, no, but it's good to get other people's perspectives.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, definitely. I guess I'll just go ahead and shut it off. So.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, Archie is the oldest, and he's probably got the best memory.